Today's message may not reach everybody, but those that it reaches, if I succeed, you will think about your own experience with God and your own life history to this moment, and what your relationship with Him is today. I don't ever just preach messages. I want you to go out of here with a little better understanding of the way God is, as revealed in this book, which tells us about the ones to which He related the most. No one else had as many experiences with God as those people that fill the pages of this book we call the Bible. God determined it would be that way. In a world with common roots, and because of those common roots, I remember studying comparative religion at Stanford, they would have me believe that this Bible is but some hybrid copy of legends and myths from other cultures. Well, go ahead and think that if you want to. Everybody has a right to be wrong. And if that's your choice, have at it. However, I find that most of those who propound that idea have a little smattering knowledge of all these different so-called streams of myth and legend from common roots, and they're almost totally ignorant of the Bible, which has its own way of gripping you when you spend time with it. The alternate idea is that in a world where everyone has common roots, somewhere way back there, not some 4,000 years B.C., which is Bishop Usher's stupid idea based on genealogy, but somewhere way back there, not in conflict with evolution. Evolution is just a theory, by the way. And furthermore, Darwin was a fraud in spite of his great heroic stature. He stole it from another man who was sick in the East Indies, and he just beat that man with the ideas he had stolen. And no matter how much experience he may have had in research, he was bettered and bested by another scientist. And there's a whole book on this fraud that I taught on festival to those that check your record of tapes. And sick near death in the East Indies, this man couldn't get to the Royal Society in time to propound the theory, which Darwin stole from him. So all these self-righteous evolutionists need to maybe quit taking somebody else's word for it and research their own philosophy and ideas at the source instead of doing what most pseudo-scholars do, just pass on what somebody else said. But evolution is okay. It's a theory. It explains an obvious stratification and a layer upon layer, increasingly complicated life form, apparent development. And evolution explains it. That doesn't have a thing in the world to do with the Bible. The Bible isn't against evolution. I've said to you probably 5,000 times, there's a vast gulf of time between Genesis 1:1, where it says, in the beginning God created, and Genesis 1:2, which literally translated reads, and the earth became a waste and a desolation. I'm in trouble with evolution. And when God got around to Adam, I can't pass it without saying it, for years I kept a monkey band. Remember that? Hundreds of them. To imitate bureaucrats. And I handed out a big scroll-like diploma from Kushu University. Come on, United States, stand up. And I gave the graduated BM award. to the monkey of the year. The bureaucrat, by his idiocy, that proved there was a missing link. He was it. Gave an MLD degree. Missing link doctor. And I handed him out on about a weekly basis to some idiotic bureaucrat who proved there was a missing link. I needed evolution. But when the Bible says, God said, let us make man in our image, He didn't say that. Ishi is the Hebrew word for man. What the literal reads, let us make Adam, the cognate of Adam. We just carried it over into our language. Let us make Adam in our image. And He formed him out of the dust of the earth. And I always marvel at those who believe that God spoke and the universe spun. And then they have difficulty that God took dust of the earth and formed Adam. And He breathed into Adam, not Ishi, Adam, not man, general, Adam. He breathed into Adam. And Adam, not man. See, English has this warped idea, you can't use the same word twice in the same language. So if the Hebrew or the Greek uses the same word two or three times properly, English translators change it. God said, let us make Adam in our image. And He formed Adam from the dust of the earth. And He breathed into Adam. And Adam became a living soul. There's not one line in that verse that uses the Hebrew word Ishi, which is man in general. He made Adam. Adam was different. Because God breathed a part of Himself into Adam. And he became a living soul. And that image of God, marred through the centuries, is that capacity in us to respond to the light of truth from God. Deep calleth unto deep. And that nature was about covered over with the sins and departure from God's light of the descendants of Adam. And though all come from a common root, God chose a man, Abram, and out of him said He would bless the whole world and bring light, ultimately culminating in the light from heaven, as I said last Sunday, becoming an outraying of God's very nature and a proof coin struck in human flesh. Jesus of Nazareth brought God from the unknown onto the stage of history and could say, when you've seen me, you've seen the Father. But before him, God related to these particular people He chose to be His oracle that He might protect the right record that has caricatures in the common memory bank of all other cultures. And in this book, you meet God's favorites. He gets mad at them plenty of times. But these are the people that God exposed Himself to the most until He brought Jesus onto the scene. And from them, as you would if you want to know somebody in today's world, if you can't meet that person directly and converse with him, then talk to the people who know him well. That's why I talk about and to these people who knew him so well. And in Psalm 46, there is a passage that if I have a text, would be it. Though I don't really want to focus on a text. I want that text to become an idea that I can translate to an experience, hopefully, for all of us today who face the problems of life as you walk out of this building every hour that you're gone. Psalm 46, verse 11. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah. You know what Selah means? Think of that. How many of you have it open to that passage, Psalm 46? You notice the Lord of hosts, capital letters, Yahweh. That self-revelatory name that tragically early Jewish scholars shoved back into the heavens and would not pronounce it in spite of the fact that God said to Moses, you've known me by my name, Elohim, plural by the way, Most High, but by my name, Yahweh, Jehovah, I will reveal myself to you. That unpronounceable to Jewish scholars, Jewish name, Hebrew name, Yahweh. Four letters, consonant, Yod, He, Vav, or Wav, He again, because it came matriculating through the Germans who did not have the letter to pronounce it properly. It became Wah. Early on, through the German, it became Vav. And we then have Yehovah, or Jehovah, as it's usually written. The Jews wouldn't pronounce it. But as I've said, God intended this to be the name by which He would reveal what He wants to be to His people. The Lord of hosts is the name here which elevates Him above everything. I could spend this whole message naming verses of Scripture where God moved the stars and the heavens according to His purposes, where He moves the hosts of demon forces. They still are under His control. Job was unable to be attacked by Satan until God's permission was given. He moves heathen nations for His purposes. He moves angels for His cause. His hardest to control are the people that He wants to voluntarily follow Him, His own people. But Lord of hosts means He's in charge of everything. Not anything in this universe that He cannot make it move to His purposes. From that height, as Lord of hosts, linked to the most impossible phrase by contrast, the Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge, or resting place, or place to which we can run. Lord of hosts, with us, God of Jacob, our refuge. Now, I would not have, to you Bible scholars, I wouldn't have any trouble at all with this phrase if it said, the Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Israel is our refuge. That wouldn't be such an incongruity. Because the God of Israel is Jacob after he changed. His name was changed from Jacob to Israel in a night experience where he wrestled with Jehovah himself in the form of a man. And he was changed that night. There's little to admire in Jacob except the rightness of what he wanted in terms of objective. His methods were all wrong. He wanted the right thing, but he went about it the wrong way. And he was broken and changed in one night. And God changed his name to Israel, which I'll say more about in a moment. But I want the introduction of this message to be, most churches would tell you to get the Lord of hosts with all of His power and all of His goodness and all of His abilities to do what you need, to get the Lord of hosts with you and for Him to be your refuge, you got to change and be like Israel. Then the Lord of hosts will be with you. And the God of Israel, changed man, will be your refuge. Now, I'm in the business of laying God's Word out with the hope that faith will connect you to God and He will change you. I hope that He's changing me a little and displacing the bad and letting the good a little bit at a time come out each year in my life until there is some progress of God bringing forth His image in me. But I have no qualms at all to stand here and say, I'm more like Jacob than I am Israel. And this verse comforts me in the knowledge that though we all need to come to the change from Jacob to Israel, the God of Jacob is still our refuge, and the Lord of hosts will be with us while we're still Jacob and not yet Israel. Now let me tell you the story. Jacob came out of the womb. Go to Genesis 32 for the story, or the end of the story. Jacob came out of the womb, grabbing his brother's heel. I don't want to try to explain it. Paul was saying you don't need an explanation when he referred to it. In fact, the context was, who are you to argue with God's sovereignty? Does the clay talk back to the potter and say, what are you making out of me? And then by illustration, he made this strange statement. While Jacob and Esau were in the mother's womb, not yet born, he said, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. These twin sons of Isaac. Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. So he started out with God on his side. But he came out of the womb with feeling a nature about himself. Now just imagine these squalling kids coming out. And this little brat has his hand locked on the heel of his brother because his brother came out first. And he's grabbing to get up front. Can you imagine that? Born, heel catcher. That's what his name means. Jacob means heel catcher. And everywhere he went throughout his life, as they would say, I'd like you to meet Jacob. Names meant something in those days. You'd start putting your heels together the minute you met him. He calls at the door to date your daughter. What's your name? Heel catcher. See, names don't mean anything to us. But names describe personality traits or callings or intentions by God or description of an act that stayed with you as a mark on you the rest of your life. He was stained at the outset. He was stained as he came out the gate with a past that stayed with him everywhere he went. When he was introduced, when he met anybody, when he said his own name, his past reared its head. And he kept the pattern up. The firstborn under the law of primogeniture, the firstborn would inherit. He knew there was a blessing that God had said to Abram, having chosen him through his descendants, but not all descendants, through a specific line. Starting out, not Ishmael, produced in fleshly action by Abram, but Isaac, the child of promise as the result of unwavering faith. Then Isaac has Jacob and Esau. Again we have the firstborn by right as Ishmael was the firstborn by right, not chosen by God, but rather another, Isaac, not Ishmael. Jacob in the womb loved, Esau hated. But Esau had the primogeniture right. He was firstborn. Jacob was trying to get there, grabbing his heel. He carried that knowledge that the blessing would one day be dispensed at his father's death that would make he and his descendants, if he had that blessing, the center stage of God-relatedness. Really, the word-bearer or light-bearer to carry God's revelation forward and to bring blessing to all mankind. He wanted that. Give him credit for right desires. But he had this shadow in front of him. Esau was firstborn. Esau was out hunting. Famished. Now think about how some of you get when I'm preaching a little long. Hunger. Only he's out having hunted all day in the open air and he's famished. And here comes little buddy heel catcher carrying the most aromatic pot or bowl or whatever they had of stew. And Esau gets a whiff. Now, in the New Testament in Hebrews, it says to the Christian, be not like that profane person Esau. I get accused of profanity. They don't even know what the word is, those fundamentalists. This is profanity. The word means not discerning the true nature of spiritual things. Some have sight, some don't. Esau never ever had the capacity to discern the true nature of spiritual things and what the real meaning of the birthright blessing, becoming the recipient of God's attentive care and part of His revelation plan. He never discerned it. To him, a bowl of soup in a moment of hunger was more important to him than God's blessing. You can see a little why God hated him. His nature kept coming out. But Jacob, he wanted God's blessing. But he didn't have enough faith to wait on God getting the job done. He had to do it. Oh, Esau is hungry. Oh, you think that Jacob went out there just because he wanted to see what the hunter Esau had bagged? He's his brother. He knew his weakness. Esau, if he could go into a supermarket, would grab everything in every single shelf. Jacob was a conniver, heel catcher. He had figured out what would get to Esau, and he comes with a soup whiffing wad. And Esau says, I'm starving, give me something. What's it worth to you? You want my soup? Sell me your birthright. You know the story. I'm taking too long to tell it. What did Esau care? He didn't discern the true nature of spiritual things. His belly was talking. Hell with his blessing. And he sold it. Jacob thus had contractual rights. Then Isaac, who's gone blind and old and about to die, announces he's going to pass on the blessing. Esau, firstborn, said to Esau, go out and kill a deer. Bring me some venison stew like only you can make. And you serve me the stew and then I'm going to bless you. Esau goes off hunting. I have an idea that Jacob and his wife were monitoring Isaac's condition better than a hospital nurse. Because they knew that somewhere before he died, he had to give this blessing. Because they overheard Isaac tell Esau, go get, kill some venison, kill a deer and bring me some venison, and I'm going to bless you. And you see Jacob with his mother as they conspire. A lot of things about Jacob I don't like. He and his mother conspire. How can we fool the old duck? You go kill a goat. Because Esau's hairy. Isaac's blind. Hair's hair when you're blind. She thought. You cover yourself with skin. You fix a stew. And you beat old Esau in there. He said, my dad will never believe it. Just trust me, his mom said. She knew Isaac better than Jacob. There, Jacob may be a conniver. His mother slept with him. She knew him. She knew him up and down, around every side of his nature, I'm telling you. She says, trust me. A lot of human traits in the Bible to those who stop trying to beat you to death with it long enough to enjoy it. She said, you trust me. Do what I'm telling you. Get in there. He went through the whole maneuver, and Isaac, you can't see, but he says, steals of him. By the way, you got to dislike Esau because he had to smell like a goat. He's feeling all these goat skins on him. He says, you know, the touch is Esau, but the voice is Jacob. It almost didn't work. But it did. And he blessed him. And he gets up. And quite rightly, his mama says, you get the hell out of here and head out of Dodge before the sun sets. Because when Esau finds out, your whatchamacallit is grass. Sure enough, here comes Esau. Can't you see him? Ah, boy, I got my stew and my blessing now. He comes in, sets it in front of Isaac and says, Papa, I'm here. You're too late, son. We both been had. Your brother Jacob fooled me. And I've given the blessing to him already. Esau let out a howl that could be heard in South Arabia. He began to wail and cry. What do I do? Give old Isaac credit. He says, what I've done is done. Him that I've blessed is blessed. I can't take it back, no matter how it was obtained. I just have to give you a little conciliatory blessing of your own, but it is not the blessing of the promises of God through Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob. And Jacob's hightailing it. He's heading east. He's back to East L.A., his roots. Then he gets back to the country where Abram had first halted, near Damascus in Syria. And he sees a girl, and it's love at first sight. Doesn't take him long. Once he's out of range of Esau, he's thinking of himself again. I gotta have her. He asked his uncle Laban, who was the father, how do I get her? You work for me 7 years, and you can have her. Oh, Jacob, he gets things in his own strength. Okay? Now, just go ahead in your mind. What have you done for the last 7 years? How long has it been? Now, that's love. 7 years he works for her. And the wedding night, can you imagine what's built up in him? Man, he's ready. 7 years. They didn't have electric lights. Those black goatskin tents were dark. And after 7 years, he wasn't about to waste time lighting a candle. He dived in. You heard me define coyote love the other night, didn't you? Coyote love is when you wake up in the morning and what you see there, you gnaw your arm off for fear of waking it up and you get out of there. Like a coyote will gnaw its leg off rather than stay in a trap. He woke up. And it wasn't the girl he worked 7 years for. Laban had tricked him and sent her ugly sister in. And he wakes up in the morning and there is not the love for which he worked 7 years, but her ugly sister. And Laban, the old cheat, he says, "You want your first choice? Another 7 years. 14 years. I'll make you a bet. I'll make you a bet, payday in heaven, but I'll make you any bet you want to bet. When we get to heaven, we check with Jacob. He lit a candle after the 14th year. I bet you. Anything you want to bet." He got even with Laban. He got even with Laban. He cheated him. He cheated him so bad that finally the only solution between the liar and the cheat, the heel grabber and the wife or the daughter swapper, the only solution was to part. They were two of a kind. And we find Jacob just in front of this chapter, journeying back to the land that was part of the promise in the blessing he had obtained by cheating from his father Isaac. And as he comes back toward his home, knowing full well that Esau was still a power in that land, he receives the bad news. Esau, learning of his return, is marching with hundreds of fighting men to meet him. And his past came marching on the scene. Now this message, everything else was introduction. The message is right at this point. And I hope you can get past the shadow of me as God's messenger today to the experience of Jacob and identify with it. There isn't any one of us that haven't got shadows and scars and problems in our past that we just want to get away from. You want to bury it and never see it again. Jacob was about to learn the truth. Indeed, he was learning it and in the midst of it, that the past has a way of marching in on us and intruding onto the present. He was facing his past. And he has an interesting phrase, because he's still the clever conniver. First he divides, first he settles with Laban. And they build a monument that was a monument of testimony that they would never get together again and avoid each other, thus never having a chance to cheat each other again. It was not a very pleasant party. And Laban then marches back to Damascus. And they've agreed to separate And Jacob is now marching toward the promised land again, and his past is there to meet him. He then divides his own people into separate camps so that they can't... He's still smart. He doesn't want to lose everything all at once, so he divides them into separate camps so that if Esau kills him and wins, at least there'll be a chance of getaway for some. Or if he comes out of it, he might lose one camp, but won't lose it all. And then God, who's still aware of Jacob, who the night he dreamed when he fled Esau, still gave a vision of a ladder to heaven and made a covenant with him, God's still there, and through some mystic experience on this same day, preluding the passage I'm going to read, he sees an invisible host of angels. And he names the place Naanaim, and ever after became a geographic Bible mark in that land, to which David later years would go to remind himself that there's always another host present, God's supernatural unseen angels. When his people confront anything, there's the host of Laban leaving, and the host of Esau coming to meet him, and his two hosts that he had separated of his own people and goods and family, but there was another host that he got a glimpse of. I mean, it doesn't give us detail. He just saw the heavenly host, angels, hovering around the scene, ready to do battle. And then, with the past marching in, he said he desired to be alone with God. That was the excuse he gave his family, who obviously were concerned. He sent them all away and said, I want to be by myself with God. The past has a way of sneaking up on us. Just when we think it's buried, it comes hurtling into our present. But what's worse is the past, when it comes sneaking in or charging in this case, sort of did a swoop around and was threatening his future. So he was not only having to confront his past threatened his future. Now, I said I failed this message today. If you just hear a sermon, you got to get past my faltering ability to communicate this experience to where it can live in your life for a moment. One great theologian defined meditation as attention with intention. Not just attention. Attention with intention. I want your attention with the intent, like trying a glove on your hand to see if it fits your circumstance. The past that we want never on the scene again. It's always gonna come marching back. That's the way life is. You're in an illusory world if you think it won't happen. And the past has a way, at least, of developing fear that is gonna affect the future. Don't impede the future. And my recommendation is, you do what Jacob did, and today with Jacob, have a meeting with God in your own mind. Because Jacob was alone, and he cried out. Jacob was left alone, crying out in the night, according to Hosea. Hosea in the 12th chapter references this same event. And that's what I like about God's book. When something's really important, it's said in enough different places, you know you're not just dealing with something incidental or peripheral. He cried out with much tears for God's help as the past threatened him. 24th verse, 32nd chapter. Jacob was left alone. Hosea says, crying with much tears. And there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. There wrestled a man with him. Now this is one of the earliest theophanies recorded in Scripture. That word simply means that God theos comes down and manifests himself, taking human form. This is one of the earliest. I'm one of those Bible students who believes that this theophany was indeed Jehovah himself, or an expression of Jesus the Christ before he took the form through the birth at Bethlehem in later years. From out of the councils of heaven he came and he took the form of a man. The important thing for you to understand is Jacob cried out for God to help him. And suddenly, to his surprise, seen there in the darkness of the night, all alone, crying out for God to help him as the past impinged upon him and threatened his future. And it says, a man, suddenly a hand's laid on him, and a man begins to wrestle with him. Jacob is the defensive one here. He's not the aggressor. He's defending himself against this man in the night who's wrestling with him. It's important to see he did not know, never even considered at the outset, that it was God. To him, he's crying out for God to help him, and this dadgum man suddenly attacks him. Let me say it a different way, because it's important. It come into your consciousness. You that maybe have the past impinging. He didn't recognize God answered his prayer. Because God was doing it in a strange way. He prayed. The night should have split apart with lightning bolts. Lights like the movie, whatever that movie is, where that big spaceship comes down. What's the name of that one? Huh? Not too many voices. Give me one close. Who? No, that I haven't seen that one. That's the new one that's making more money than it should. Way back there. Who? Just one. You, Brad.
Close Encounters.
Close Encounters. Look. Don't give me kid movies. Go back to where there's enough maturity behind us to have a past. I got the time. Reminds me of the guy that was going to impress a crowd in French West Africa. There were 5,000 people or more there. And he said he was going to show off he could speak French. But he's going to preach without an interpreter. And he said to him, I'm going to preach to you today about my past. But what he said was mon derrière. Well, they all started laughing all over the field. Then he was worse. He went on to say, mon derrière, avec Dieu. Heart. My past, he meant to say my history, but he said my behind. My sermon today is about my behind, and he went on to say, furthermore, my behind has two parts. close encounters. He expected a light to come out of heaven like that. Come down. And God to reveal himself as 900 feet tall. Until the very sight of it would bring awe to his bands. And Esau would be blind, stopped, dead. He prayed for God to help him with much tears. And there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of day. A wrestling match. Just see him fighting and see him struggling in the darkness. I'm praying to God to help me, and I'm being attacked by this dad-blamed man out of the dark. God's ways are not our ways. He couldn't recognize that God was there meeting him at his level, disguised as a man. Some of you that have been crying out, wanting God to somehow come like close encounters in a great, glorious blaze of light with an eraser so he can erase your past. And then you walk the next morning unscathed into the sunlight. My past is gone, never to intrude again. Maybe what you've been wrestling with in the struggle is God in disguise, trying to bring you to a point where the past cannot do this to you anymore. And what I want you to see that's very important is God limits himself. I've said this to you over the last several weeks. The devil, who's very real and alive, he doesn't ask permission to take control of your life. God wants your freedom not obliterated. He wants you to make a choice. He didn't want to force it. In this case, it's sort of amazing. He cried out for God in desperation, and God's exercising more active offensive, on the offense intrusion, then we have a right to count on when the simple word says we're to trust him. But God answered his prayer and intruded in the form of a man. God hears your prayers, and God knows about your past, and God knows about your future, which you don't know, and he was there, wanting to get Jacob under control, the man that would never let God control him, would always run ahead of God and do God's work for him. God can't be counted on, so I'll do it. I'll grab his heel coming out. I'll steal his birthright with soup. I'll disguise myself and lie to my father. I'll cheat my relatives. Now I'm cornered. The past is on my back. And God is there. But he doesn't recognize him. He's just a man. And God, as the angel wrestling with him, wasn't winning. You read Hosea 12, you read this passage. As long as Jacob was whole, it's an amazing story. The angel couldn't conquer him. Man, what a guy to have in a fight with you. He's holding his own with better than Mike Tyson. He's holding his own with Jehovah incarnate as a man. They wrestle back and forth all night long. Some of you are the same way. I'm the same way. God disguised as the circumstances. God leading me. You acknowledge him in all your ways. He'll direct your path. We just don't like the path he directs. You commit your way unto him, and he will direct your path.
We just don't like His direction. Because He doesn't come with all these, that's why all these other churches with their funny, funny stuff and their charlatans for Jesus have such crowds. We want the spectacular. We don't want God to work it out. Step by step, hour by hour, in the dark of the night. And Jacob, who's a heel catcher, he's a fighter. And the scripture says the angel wrestled with him and prevailed not. He couldn't bring Jacob down, just him back and forth wrestling all night long. And as daylight approaches, God has enough. Jacob as a whole man will not yield. Jacob with his stiff necked heel catching traits will not give way. He's going to fight. And finally, as daylight approaches, the angel puts his hand on his thigh and cripples him. Now he's no longer whole. And as a crippled man, he starts losing the fight. Until, as it's described, all he can do is just clinch. Like boxers that are about knocked out in the ring, they clinch. All he can do is hang on. And in that moment, I am totally convinced, in that moment, for the first time, Jacob realized he was wrestling with more than a man. When this man he wrestled with just touched him and disjointed his thigh and crippled him, there had to be pain. And in that moment of crippling, insight came. It's God Himself that I'm wrestling against. It's against His control. I want the blessing. I want for me. I want God to be my servant. I want God to do things my way. I want it to turn out right. I don't deserve my past impinging in. I don't deserve my future threatened. I know that God wants this for me. I'm God's favorite, and I should get it. But never, ever would submit to anything, much less external control or internal, however you want to describe the mystery of yielding to God. He didn't want to move off the throne of his own life and say, "Here, God, you take me and do it your way." Your son hung in shame between two thieves. For sins he did not do, he hung there for mine. We're not willing to give up. But in that moment of crippling, the whole man kept resisting. The crippled man could only cling, and he recognized that God's hand had been on him that night. And the angel said, as the dawn approached, "Release me. The morning light is about to appear." And Jacob said, "I will not let you go until you bless me." He knew that the blessing that he had obtained through trickery had that canker on it. Now he says to the angel, "I won't let you go until you bless me." And in that clinging, right attitude of submission, the angel says, "What's your name? What's your name?" There in the darkness. Now he knew who, Jacob knew who it was. And he says, "What's your name?" All the past is embraced. Jacob, heel catcher. That's what I am. And in that moment of confession, which we only have to do to God, you don't have to do it to anybody else, everything came out. Notice, guys, and the angel says, "Thou hast been called Jacob, heel catcher. But now, from now on, you're going to be called, we say, Israel, Yisrael." Just four letters. Yod, Sin, Resh, Lamed. All of the four letters come together. Yes, Riel. I skipped through and left out the little vowel-sounding consonant that's silent, Aleph. L is the two-letter word, Yisr. Y-S-R. Yisr, L. You know what the literal meaning of that is? Because it's two words. Literally, that word means God commanded, God contended, God preserveth, God persevereth, God determineth. All those things are mixed in. Suddenly it shifts from Israel grabbing from God to God contending, God controlling, God preserving, God directing, God controlling, God governing. The word simply means God governs. Two words brought together. Yod, Sin, Resh, Aleph, Lamed. Yes, Yisr, El. Yisrael. Israel, we say. Governed by God. That's what the issue is. And then what happened? The angel disappears, and the sun comes up, and in that crimson morning light, you got to imagine this figure coming out of the darkness, marching from the place that he named Penuel, which means I've seen the face of God, marching from Penuel into the sunrise with a limp. He'll carry that limp the rest of his life. Everywhere he goes, he'll limp. To remind him of the night that God in the form of a man wrestled with him and then crippled him, and then clingingly he asked God to write the blessing, and his nature changed. He then miraculously went with courage in his heart. He had met God. He says, I've seen God face to face, and I've not died. My life has been spared. And now he cares nothing about fast. He marches toward Esau, and God was already there. God went to Esau and changed him. God met Esau while he was getting ready to go meet Esau. And Esau fell on his breast and embraced him. And for the first time, they related as brothers. That's the happy sequel. The message is, if we'll submit to God and let Him control us, He puts Himself between us and our past. He's able to take care of it. He puts us, as He did in front of Esau. He puts Himself between us and our future. The Lord of hosts, reduced down to the commonplace experience that you've been going through, as He reached out and found you wherever you are and brought you into contact with His light, just because He doesn't come like the spaceship of close encounters. He is working with you, and His purposes are to be achieved only when you finally, once for all, quit bargaining with God and say, work it out your way. All I know is I can trust you. Don't make Him cripple you. You have to walk with a limp because your stubborn nature would not give way to God's claims, and because you keep fighting against God working in your life to straighten it out. Don't make Him cripple you. But if there's no other way, it'll be the most blessed limp that you can have, if you can finally come to the trusting relationship that you'll cling on to God and say, I won't let go until you work it out. And He will. The past is in all of us. It'll come marching in. You cling to God. He's between you and the past, and between you and the future. and the steps of a good man are ordered of the Lord. The God of Jacob, if you haven't yet reached the point of submission, the Lord of hosts is with us. He can work it out. But to you that are still wrestling, the God of Jacob is your refuge. He came to Jacob while he was Jacob. He didn't wait till he became Israel before he came. That's the start and the finish of this message. To we Jacobs, still wrestling, there's hope. There is hope. The God of Jacob is our refuge. That's the hope. The advice is that you quit bucking against the Lord of hosts. Because when He wants you, He's going to stay on your case. And He's working even though you don't recognize Him. And the sooner you commit yourself and quit wrestling against it, the sooner He can get ahead of you and become between you and your future and take care of your past. This is a message about God's love, the wrestler in the night. He loves you and He loves me as Jacob. Don't ask too much of Him. Submit to Him and become God-governed. Because I can tell you, if I could sing it this morning, I would. This message is summed up in that song I used to play on the saxophone so often. Could we with ink the ocean fill? And were the skies of parchment made? Were every stone on earth a quill? And every man a scribe by trade? To write the love of God above would drain the ocean dry, nor could the scroll contain the whole, though stretched from sky to sky. That's the message to the Jacobs and the struggling ones and with the scars and with the past. You're in good hands if you just let go of yourself long enough to trust the God who's written your name on that parchment, who will see you through. A message of love and a message of faith in the one who loves you. That's my message today, and I want to...